It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, in for Kevin Gavin. 6 years after he was critically wounded by a Pittsburgh police officer, and it led to a career as a well-known activist, Leon Ford, now 25, says he wants to have an even greater impact on the Pittsburgh community, not only through his voice as a public speaker, but by winning a seat on city council. Leon Ford joins us in studio now. Leon, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
For those who don't know your story, you were left paralyzed from the chest down after an officer shot you during a traffic stop. That experience has always been so central to your activism. How might it inform your run for city council?
I remember sitting in rooms where people would talk about police violence and gun violence, and I wanted more representation of my voice. And so now I'm being in a position where I've exemplify what leadership is. I've organized, I've protested, I've traveled nationally, training police officers. I've also worked in the nonprofit sector, worked for VC firms. And now I'm just looking forward to using my voice to evoke change.
How did the events this summer, the shooting of Antoine Rose, affect your decision?
I thought about it. I had the idea to run for office before the Antoine Rose shooting. After the Antoine Rose shooting, I was inspired to do more. You know, it's one thing to travel the country, sharing my story, encouraging young people to get involved. But it's another thing to actually stand up and be about what I was talking about. And the Antoine Rose situation created a sense of urgency. Because I recognize that if we weren't going to be more transparent about these issues, then unfortunately they're going to continue to happen.
District 9 incumbent Reverend Ricky Burgess is finishing his third four-year term. Do you think that he's failed his constituents, or do you want more out of the district?
I respect him, you know, as a leader, but I think it's time for new ideas, and I'm just looking forward to, you know, bringing something new to the table.
Did you talk to him about your candidacy?
I have not spoke to him about my candidacy, but I've seen him in person. And, sometimes he's not the easiest person to talk to, unfortunately, but I still love him and I still respect him.
People in the district and across the city of Pittsburgh know your name. Do you think that gives you a bit of a political edge?
Yes, I think the name recognition is going to help out a lot. But I also think what's more important than the name recognition is the fact that I'm a listener, right? And so I'm in the community. I'm of the community, born and raised in District 9. And one of my strengths is listening. And so I'm able to, you know, create spaces for people to get their voices heard.
District 9, which does include big swaths of the northern part of the East End, has been a pretty crowded field the last couple of elections. Burgess never actually won a majority. What do you think you can do to keep any would-be challengers maybe out of the contest this time?
Yeah, so I've been reaching out to people who are thinking about running for office as well. And I think it comes down to just having conversations. Most of us have similar platforms. You know, most of us are affected by the same issues. And so I believe that I've been positioned to be a good candidate. And I'm open to receiving their assistance because, I mean, I'm a student. You know, I'm not trying to jump in this race and discredit some of the elders who are considering running. I would rather work with them. I mean, I work with, you know, police officers, and some of these police officers have views that go against what I believe in. But you know, I'm able to sit in these rooms and have these conversations that are very productive. And even though we have opposing viewpoints and perspectives, we're able to work together. And that's what true community is about.
You talked about trying to be a listener at heart. You're actually in the middle of a listening tour yourself. What have you learned so far about the needs of your constituents, your neighbors?
Yes. Oh, man. We probably spent close to an hour talking about affordable housing. We've spent a lot of time talking about gun violence in the communities. We've spent a lot of time talking about how to engage youth, all of the pain points of the community. And the community, they spent a lot of time talking about their frustrations with Reverend Burgess. And so, you know, I don't want to run a campaign that's geared toward, you know, talking about what he hasn't done. But it's interesting to listen to these stories and try to find innovative solutions to, you know, assist families moving forward and prevent some of the displacements from happening in the future.
What kind of role do you see yourself taking on in those conversations? Are you the facilitator? Are you a moderator? Do you bring people to the table? Do you affect change more specifically through some kind of legislation?
Yes. So as a grassroots organizer, one of my strengths is to facilitate. And it takes a very special person to facilitate these type of conversations, because there has to be that mutual trust and that mutual respect. You know,
how do you build that trust, though, if it doesn't exist, if it's not already there? Is trusting you enough?
Yeah, it's all relationships, you know, and being in community, being a genuine person. I think one of the strengths that I have is that people, they're able to see my pain. Right. And they know my story, and they see me working with police officers, and they're like, man, how do you do it? You know what I mean? Because I'm struggling with this, right? So when they see me, they're already comfortable sharing their vulnerability. They're comfortable sharing their pain and their trauma because they see me wearing it. They see me speaking about it. And so I think naturally people are open to talking to me about these things.
Do officers share that vulnerability? Will they talk to you and members of the community with the same level of trust and respect?
There are police officers who are open to it, but there are also police officers who are not open to it. I think, you know, collectively, as long as, you know, we're being honest, we're being open, we're being transparent, that we can move toward a community where, you know, the police officers are able to have these type of conversations. But again, it starts with building relationships and building organic relationships, you know. It's more than... You know, it's more than just showing up to a football game and, you know, meeting people, or it's more than having a community event, inviting people out. I mean, we really got to get to a point where we're being intentional about meeting our neighbors, about living amongst our neighbors. And I know that Pittsburgh police officers don't have to live in the city, but I think it'd be... it'd be great if they spent more time in the city and more time in the communities that they're serving, to get to know people, to get to understand the history of, you know, some of these communities, you know, the history of the successes, and also the failures and the pain that some community folks are carrying.
District 9 includes a pretty large portion of Police Zone 5, which gets a lot of credit for violent crime, but also community outreach. What do you think that officers in Zone 5 are doing right? What more could they be doing?
A lot of times you hear people talk about community police relationships, right? Like we're not, as if we're not one community. You just cross out police and you say community relationships. I mean, that's what we have to get into, because when we say community police relationships, we're trying to heal community police relationship, we're insinuating that and we're implying other. And I think, you know, language is important. And when we, you know, put together events and we say community police, community and policing relationships, community and police building, we have to move beyond othering.
You mentioned kind of going back to that affordable housing piece. Advocates have said that the city needs thousands more units. During one of the listening sessions, you took a little heat on where you live now, Walnut Capitol Building in East Liberty. What did you say to folks who might criticize you for that?
Yes. So I live in Walnut Capitol, and it's very expensive.
Right.
It's very expensive. And so... a lot of people think because I received a settlement that I can afford to live there. But in fact, you know, from a financial literacy standpoint, you know, having a lump sum of money does not equate to having income.
That settlement was the result of a civil lawsuit alleging excessive force. You settled in January for $5.5 million.
Right. And so I'm stuck because there's not a lot of handicap accessible units in the district. The ones that are accessible are subsidized. And there's a long waiting list. It's very hard for me to find housing in the district. Some people would say, hey, you have the money, just build a house. But because the way many of the lots are set up, it's hard to build a ranch style house in the city, right? And so I have to, you know, I spoke to a few companies about around building a house, and it's very expensive. To even build a two bedroom house, it's over $300,000.
How would you address concerns about a lack of affordable or accessible housing in the city?
So, you know, and this is why we're still doing the listening tours, because a lot of the residents, they've been doing this type of they've been doing this work longer than I've been alive, you know. And so right now I'm just, you know, in a space of listening to hear what the community has to say.
What do you wish people knew about Leon Ford?
That's a very great question. Wow. I wish people knew that Leon Ford is a loving individual. I'm not here to divide. I'm not here to hate anyone. I'm just here to do good things. You know, I'm a student. Again, I'm not saying that I know it all. I'm not saying that I have all the answers. I'm not saying I have all the solutions. But I'm a listener, because I know that the residents of District 9 and the residents of Pittsburgh, they know what they need. And they are very intelligent. They are very responsible. And so as we, you know, embark on this listening tour, we're going to collect these voices and come up with the most innovative solutions. And in fact, I don't want the listening tour to stop, you know, in a couple weeks. I don't want the listening tour to stop, you know, after the election. I would love for the listening tour to become a part of the fabric of not only District 9, but the city of Pittsburgh, because it's important and it's imperative that we give the residents of Pittsburgh a voice. And that's what, you know, I represent, and that's what I'm doing.
Activist Leon Ford is a candidate in the city council race for District 9. Leon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Just ahead on The Confluence, an interview with a Carnegie Mellon University environmental economist who says that air pollution impacts income equality. We'll ask him why. Then a local mayor is connecting the dots between pollution, equity, and health. We'll take a look at a program that gives citizens the skills to keep watch over local smokestacks, and a preview of a night of music and healing to benefit the survivors of the Tree of Life shooting. Stories, interviews, conversations, and more every day from 9 to 10 a.m. on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Find us online or wherever you get your podcasts.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. The work of Pittsburgh School Security Officer Nakia Ingram goes well beyond her job title. What started as informal mentoring during lunch breaks and weekends at Brashear High School has led to the creation of Cultivating Resilient Youth. Ingram discussed the after-school program with 90.5 WESA's Elaine Effort.
With me working inside of the schools, I saw there was a need for kids to have additional support for some of the things that they needed to do to help them build self-confidence, help them navigate through their lives, and just make sure they have the support that they need to be successful.
And why did you think this was something you could do? You were working every day in the schools. work all day and still do this additional program?
I thought back to when I was younger and some additional help that I needed. So I wanted to make sure that I was that for the kids that I was working with. So I would find time on my lunch break, stay after school with them. I started to meet them on weekends, get them job applications, dropping them homework off. I would go online at night to find any job leads and any of that kind of stuff and take it and give it to the kids.
What did they think of you?
They were very, very appreciative, and then they would let other kids know. I've worked at Beshear High School for 10 years, and they're still students from 10 years ago that I still talk to today because of the relationships that we've built. And in turn, they help, they come, and they come back and mentor the kids that I work with now. And so it's just seeing a need and making sure that I was just a support that most of us needed when we were younger.
And so it started off with a few students, and then it grew and grew, and now you have a more formalized program. How does it work?
Originally, I started off working with everyone, and I still kind of do boys and girls, but one thing that I have witnessed throughout these years is that males get a lot of support, and girls don't get the same support. They're worried about the way boys are being raised and their well-being, but not girls.
How do you specifically help the girls?
They kind of tell me what they need, and then I provide them with what they need. So we just had a speaker for domestic violence, dating, self-confidence. We talk about the prison pipeline, how it affects girls, restorative justice, attitude. We just kind of work on just being a woman and navigating in a male space and owning it and making sure that they're as strong as they can be. So giving the women and the girls a voice, make them powerful enough where they don't allow to be pushed to the side.
What about their grades and their academic performance?
We have 27 girls. We had 11 girls with high honor roll or honor roll. We do a competition to see who gets the highest GPA. The last semester, we had three young ladies who won. We had a 3.7, a 3.6, and a 3.5. They won gift cards, $100 to $50. Right now, we have three 4.0s because they're trying to outbeat each other. Like, no, I want the highest GPA. So we really make it fun and something that they can really strive for, to know that as part of helping their self-confidence, helping them get into college, scholarships. It's been a blessing for me to have the last 5 years, girls from 5 years ago, they still come back. And they mentor the girls that we have now. And they really build friendships and sisterhoods that stay and that I've watched develop and continue for years.
Thank you, Nakia Ingram.
Thank you.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Air pollution might seem like a problem that's out of the average person's control, but there's an EPA program that gives citizens the skills to keep watch over local smokestacks. For the Allegheny Front's exploration of how pollution is impacting the health and well-being of the people who live here, Andy Cubis heads to a class that trains certified emissions observers, better known as smoke readers.
So good morning again. Welcome to day two of our Pittsburgh Smoke School.
The parking lot at the Settlers Ridge Wave Pool, just outside of Pittsburgh, is filled with camping chairs. The people sitting in them are looking up at the sky as if they're waiting for a fireworks show to begin. But it's early in the morning, and this group is here for the Visible Emissions Observer Certification and Training Program.
We call it Smoke School because it's easier to say.
That's Roger Rooks. He's a field instructor for a company called Eastern Technical Associates, based in North Carolina. A certified smoke reader needs to be recertified twice a year. So every 6 months, they haul their odd-looking blue trailer up to the Pittsburgh region for smoke school. The trailer has a giant stack in the middle that folds on a hinge. When it's time for the field test, the operator programs it to send different types of smoke into the air.
Dark charcoal gray 75, remember not that black.
The key to passing smoke school is being able to tell whether what's coming out of the stack is steam or something much worse.
Well, steam is going to be close to, if not 100% opacity. It typically looks like a nice big puffy cloud. If it's an emission, you can actually watch as that plume spreads out, gets diluted by the air, and becomes thinner and thinner and thinner. Whereas steam typically has a finite point where it goes from being visible to invisible.
My name is Greg Poindexter. And I'm out here reading smoke, and I work with the Allegheny County Health Department.
How's it going?
Well, we'll see after we get it graded.
Anyone can go to smoke school. Most attendees are regulators like Poindexter, but some are lawyers, permit writers, or industry managers. A handful are environmentalists who want to learn how to keep an eye on big polluters in their communities. Melanie Mead is one of them.
I'm terrible with distance, but I'd say that steel mill's in my backyard.
Meek's two-story brick home sits on top of a cliff with a view of the Clairton Coke Works.
And you get to see our beautiful and lovely Clairton Park, and then you see our small community down bottom, and then you are hit with industry. Tons of concrete buildings, stacks, about 50. You can see 10 really tall ones.
The U.S. steel plant is the largest coke works in North America, baking coal at high temperatures to make more than 4 million tons of coke a year, a key component in steelmaking. Today is a beautiful clear day, and Meek says the stacks aren't blowing out as much steam or smoke as they do on a hazy or cloudy day.
Especially on a rainy day. It looks like the whole place is on fire down there.
Meek is still working towards her official smoke reader certification. As we look through the giant stained glass windows in her kitchen that frame the coke works, I ask her what she's looking for.
We look at this plume when we first started seeing it. It was going straight up and white until it reached about middle of the sky there. But now that dissipation, it's not just gray. It's a dark gray to me. I know it's a huge plume, but if it's steam, it shouldn't take that long to go away. That's still sitting at the top there. What is that sitting up there?
There's a good chance what's sitting up in the air is soot, or PM2.5. The small particles can settle in your lungs and cause health problems, including heart disease and asthma. The Clairton Coke Works has been in violation of clean air laws for years. U.S. Steel is appealing the latest order, a $1 million fine from the Allegheny County Health Department, for what the agency calls, quote, ever-increasing visible emissions and unexplained exceedances. Thanks to Smoke School, Mead is getting good at spotting these problems.
And that is empowering to know, because when you talk to someone who works at the mill and they say, oh, no, it's not, it wasn't. And I don't know it all, but I know enough to know this isn't right and that isn't right and this can be done better. And that's what gives you strength to speak up for others, speak up for yourself, and to keep going, to keep at it, to keep at it.
I think Melanie is very enthusiastic to help her community, and that takes time and effort.
That's Sue Seppi, a project manager at the Group Against Smog and Pollution. She finds volunteers willing to go to smoke school and then helps them along the way. She says the health department respects the role the volunteers play.
The health department wants an efficiently run facility. They want them to be meeting the requirements of the regulations, and I think the more pressure that they can put on them, the better.
The volunteer smoke readers go out once a month. If they see a violation, they call the facility directly, and they also file a report with the health department. In a statement, U.S. Steel says when reports are received, they are investigated internally and acted upon as necessary. Back in Clairton, Melanie Meek says she's going to keep learning about what's in the air she breathes. There's too much sickness in her town.
A young woman just passed away here in our community, I believe of pancreatic cancer, but I do know it was cancer for sure, at the age of 40. So we've had 5 deaths within the last 2 weeks.
Meek says her inspiration to do this work comes from her late father, who loved Clairton.
Why would he put a picture window to the view of that steel mill, but if not as a reminder, there's always work to do living here. There's always work to do.
Mead hopes to be a fully certified smoke reader by spring. For The Confluence, I'm Andy Kubis.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kara Holsoppel of the Allegheny Front. Air pollution affects our health and, as it turns out, has a big impact on income inequality. That's according to a study published earlier this year. One of its authors is Nick Muller, the Lester and Judith Lave Professor of Environmental Economics and Public Policy at Carnegie Mellon University. He and a colleague wrote an opinion piece about their findings in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. So I visited Muller at his office and asked him to read a portion of the newspaper article and talk it over with me.
It is well known that air pollution has a panoply of adverse effects on society. What might surprise the casual observer is that air pollution actually contributes to the widening gap between Pittsburgh's haves and have-nots.
So how do you come to that conclusion?
It's widely known that in the environmental justice movement, exposure to pollution tends to be higher for folks of lower income than for folks who are more well-to-do.
That's because they live where industry is situated.
Generally speaking, yes. What our work found, however, was when you looked at the health impacts and then monetized those health impacts and used those monetized damages to construct a new measure of income for people across the income distribution, that the inequality in the distribution of that measure of income was far worse than in regular old market income and wages.
And there was a figure, the percentage.
So the standard measure of income inequality comes in two forms. There's a Gini coefficient, which is just a number between 0 and 1 that represents how unequal the distribution of income is. And in the U.S. in the year 2014, we reported market income Ginis that were on the order of 0.5, which is very much what the federal government reports. When we looked at the air pollution adjusted measure of income, it was much higher. It was on the order of 0.65. Another measure of the income distribution are what are called shares. And for the lowest 20% of income, we found for market income, we found a share of something like 3 to 5% of market income, whereas folks in the top 20% had over 50% of market income. However, when we looked at the adjusted measure of income, the share of income earned by folks below the 20th percentile was actually negative. And that implied that the damages from air pollution health effects for those folks was very high. And furthermore, the reallocation of income between the 20th and over 80th percentile households was bracingly symmetric, implying that when you take into account exposure to environmental pollutants, it's a near perfect swap between the lowest 20% and the highest 20%.
You described it as a regressive tax.
I did, and others have as well. And the basic idea is that there's monetary cost associated with firms and consumers' choices specifically related to the production of air pollution. And those costs can be thought of as an implicit tax on recipients' welfare, right? And so the regressive piece of that is just the nature that it's very concentrated. The magnitude of that, of those external costs, is very much concentrated in the lower income quantiles of the distribution.
What do you mean by costs? What are the costs?
The costs are things like increased chances of death associated with exposure to fine particles. This has been known in the epidemiological and economic literature for decades. There are also cost of illness associated with things like asthma and COPD, emergency room visits, lost work days, kids' lowered attendance at schools. All of those are costly to individuals and households. Some of those are amenable to monetization, and therefore we can represent them in dollar terms.
Why is there that relationship between what happens to people in the lower 20% of income and, you know, people in the highest 20%? How do you explain that trade-off?
One piece of the research that motivated the op-ed found that a very important component to this regressivity was the baseline health status of people across the income distribution. And in particular, we found that even if pollution had changed uniformly across households in the income distribution, that the lower income folks would have been disproportionately harmed because their baseline rates of disease and death were so much higher. So you add a little bit more pollution to their exposure, to their daily lives, and it's that much harder than, say, someone who is at the high end of the income distribution and has a better baseline health status. That was an important contributing factor.
What about the people in the middle?
The people in the middle were actually not terribly affected in terms of their relative position. It's not that there weren't important exposures and mortality events and risks associated with exposure. It's when we went from the market income distribution, and we looked at the shares, to the pollution-adjusted income distribution, and we looked at the shares, the amount, the share of income being earned by folks between the 20th and the 80th percentiles was basically unchanged. It was really that symmetric swap from the low income to the high income once environmental pollution was taken into account.
So what is the solution to narrowing this gap?
Well, one solution is working on baseline health status. increasing efforts to lower rates of smoking, to increase improved diets, to improve access to healthcare. And so there's a variety of policy and educational levers that could certainly do that. Another important point is just to keep reducing levels of fine particles, PM2.5. We know these substances adversely affect a variety of metrics of health status, including premature death. We have relatively tough standards in the U.S. We need to maintain enforcement of those standards so that we continue to reduce exposures to that dangerous pollution.
So environmental policy helps all of us, but it could help people in that lower 20% income bracket more.
An interesting way to think about what the study found is that environmental policy, and in particular air pollution policy, could act as a means to reduce income inequality.
Nicholas Muller is the Lester and Judith Lave Associate Professor of Environmental Economics and Public Policy at Carnegie Mellon University. There's a link to Muller's work on income inequality and air pollution at AlleghenyFront.org. There you can find all of our stories in our Hazardous to Your Health series. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kara Holsapple of the Allegheny Front. In our last installment of our look at communities bearing the brunt of pollution, we head to Wilkinsburg, just over the border from the city of Pittsburgh. There, a young, energetic, first-term mayor is connecting the dots between pollution, equity, and health. Allegra Battle has her story.
And for coming out to this month's Public Safety Forum. As we have mentioned, I believe this
It's Wednesday evening, and about a dozen community members and administrative staff meet in the basement of the Wilkinsburg Borough Building. The century-old facility is big and a bit worn. It houses everything from the police department to the public library and finance office.
So my name is Mayor Marita Garrett, mayor here in Wilkinsburg. I feel we're such an engaged community, so it's great to have these forums.
Marita Garrett, a 32-year-old African-American, has become a rising star, traveling this year to Australia and Malaysia to talk about her community. She also co-hosts a podcast about women shattering the glass ceiling. The Akron, Ohio native fell in love with Wilkinsburg after buying a home there 8 years ago. Back in her office, she says she feels a strong sense of community pride.
It's my home. I mean, I know, but I mean, that's what it is. When you make someplace your home is your home, and you almost will do anything to protect that.
The pride she carries for Wilkinsburg is what led her into politics, first becoming a member of the Wilkinsburg Borough Council. In her first year as mayor, she says she's working on changing some of the negative perceptions of her community. Perceptions like blight and crime have plagued the area for decades.
There were many neighboring communities, including Wilkinsburg in the late 80s, especially with the log gang, who suffered at the hands of the crack epidemic and associated violence and increasing gang violence at that time. But, you know, we're 20 plus years removed in that.
Within the last year and a half, Wilkinsburg received more than $1.6 million in funding to help demolish 100 blighted properties. The mayor says her focus on Wilkinsburg reaches the entire region, especially when it comes to environmental issues like air quality. For economically disadvantaged communities like Wilkinsburg, studies have shown that residents are more likely to be exposed to pollutants. And with nearly a quarter of Wilkinsburg's 16,000 residents living below the poverty line, Garrett says those statistics are critical to her people.
In a lot of the lower income, underserved communities, you'll see the higher increase in indexes of, you know, worse air quality, underperforming education, food deserts, lack of access, which just further broadens the disparities that we face here.
And health issues resulting from poor air quality, like asthma, can hit hard for Wilkinsburg residents.
That's a part of equity. This county, we all deserve quality of life. So whether that's quality of air, our water, education, etc., anything that affects our daily life, there should be equitable access to that. And it's your zip code shouldn't be a predictor of what type of services or what type of health conditions or hazards are you exposed to.
So she's taking a holistic approach, bringing in fresh produce to her community, creating a more vibrant business district, and even addressing energy issues.
Wilkinsburg, we did ban fracking, and we really came out when a couple years ago it was a hot issue in Churchill. So we went to advocate for Churchill to not have fracking either, which thankfully they successfully were able to ban fracking as well.
But for Garrett, environmental and economic improvement begin with changing the way outsiders view her community.
A lot of people, you know, when they actually come to Wilkinsburg, they visit, get to meet some of the residents, support the businesses, realize that that perception is wrong.
And for Garrett, perception is everything, especially when it comes to building up the neighborhoods and people of Wilkinsburg. For The Confluence, I'm Allegra Battle.
You can find all of the reporting on environmental health in our series, Hazardous to Your Health, at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. I'm Kara Holsapple of the Allegheny Front, and it's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. It's been just over 7 weeks since a gunman shot and killed 11 people at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Squirrel Hill. Six others are still recovering, and the city is trying to heal. Joining us in studio is Abby Goldstein, general manager of WESA's sister station, WYEP. Welcome back, Abby.
Thank you, Megan.
Abby, WYEP is lending its megaphone to the cause tomorrow night. Tell us about the event.
Well, the Concert for the Tree of Life is a music event. We are actually broadcasting it live on WYEP. It is a fundraising event for the Victims of Terror Fund through the Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh. And we felt that we could bring people together to sort of heal through music.
Do you think that WYEP, a station for the public, had a unique responsibility to help?
I think we do, because we are a nonprofit. And so I do think that we have a unique position and a unique role to play in helping to uplift this community. Our mission is to enrich the community through music. And if the community needed any enriching, right, it's right now.
Like so many events in the wake of this tragedy, this concert is something of a collaboration. Proceeds to charity, tons of donations to make it happen. How did it all come together?
I started making phone calls, and our program director, Mike Sauter, started making phone calls within 48 hours of the shooting. We had interest from a lot of different places. Stage AE stepped up. They've donated the space and all of their labor costs. And there's been a lot of other interesting things that have happened. The folks from Drusky allowed Michael Glabicki to play our event, even though he's playing at Jurgles later on in the month. The folks from Opus One allowed Joe Grishecki to play our event. So there was a lot of folks that sort of stepped forward and said, sure, we will help you. So there really has been a beautiful outpouring of community support to make these fundraising events happen.
You mentioned a couple of artists there. Who else do we have to look forward to?
Well, we've got Jorma Kaukonen, who is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We've got Sean Rao, another amazing singer-songwriter whose manager lives right here in Pittsburgh. We've got Daya, who, of course, was on our first Reimagination album and is a Grammy winner herself, Joe Grishecki and the House Rockers, which I think are really going to tear it up. Philadelphia's Low Cut Connie, whose frontman Adam Wiener is Jewish, and they were here 2 days before the shooting, and they feel very personally affected. We've also got Brooke Annabelle, a Pittsburgh artist, Jessica Bitsura, who's a young up-and-coming artist who wrote a song, Hello Neighbor, about the shooting. So it's going to be a really, I think, a lovely lineup, a very eclectic group of artists, but I think it's going to be an amazing night of music.
And tickets are still on sale?
Tickets are on sale. They're only $25. You can get them through Ticketmaster. You can also get them at the Stage AE box office, which is open noon to 9, and the service fees are much lower if you go directly through Stage AE, and they will be available at the door.
Abby Goldstein is the general manager of our sister station, WYEP. Abby, thanks so much.
Thank you, Megan.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on The Confluence, they stepped in after 9/11, the Deepwater Horizon spill, the Pulse nightclub shooting, and when Agent Orange poisoned American soldiers after Vietnam. Now they're mediating the proposed Victims Compensation Fund for the Pittsburgh Diocese in the wake of its predator priest scandal. Attorneys Camille Biros and Ken Feinberg join us tomorrow. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kosinski. Production assistance from Meg Fair and Mick Stinelli. I'm Megan Harris, in for Kevin Gavin. I'll be back with you tomorrow. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.